Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Hi, you're with Michael Bagram, and you are here with us every Tuesday morning between 9 and 10. I always have wonderful guests, and I've actually chosen the most brilliant guest today. Now, we'll be introducing her to you in a few minutes, but the show is known as Bags on Politics and People. And please, if you have any suggestions or any brickbats that you want to throw at me, I'm happy to receive it. So just email me or phone me. I'm happy to receive any comments. I do have comments every week. I'd get lovely SMSs and WhatsApps. Some of them aren't so lovely, but what the hell? Please send it on and let's have fun on the program. So today I have MP Glynis Breytenbach, Advocate Glynis Breytenbach. I've known since 2014. It was a seminal time in her life, 2014, because she met me. And I must just tell you that we've had lots of fun, ups and downs, of course, but we've had lots of fun in Parliament together. I can tell you lots of little stories, but you'll probably beat the hell out of me if I tell you too many of them. But one thing I want to do is I want to spend a little bit of time just introducing you to Glynis. She will then take us through some of her history. And then I want to then take you through some of the history of the last 12 years in Parliament and what we've done and some of the times we've had together. Well, first of all, and I think this is imperative, and everyone who hasn't read it, you must read this book. It's called A Memoir, Rule of Law by Glynis Breytenbach. An absolutely wonderful book. I have it on my shelf and I've read it and I've gone back to it again. In fact, in preparing for today, I had a good chuckle while reading it again. And now this time reading it with a person that I actually know. When I first read it, I wasn't all that intimate with Glynis, not in the physical sense, but and as a person. And we've become great friends. She might deny that, but we have become great friends. Now, in reading this book, it'll give you a wonderful insight into Glynis. She chose a wonderful author as well, Nechama Brody, who put together the book for Glynis. Glynis is busy. Glynis is forever doing 100 things at the same time. And I want to thank Nechama publicly for putting this together and bringing it to our attention. Now, when I first met Glynis, we were sitting at a bench together right at the back of Parliament, being proverbial backbenchers. Both of us didn't have a history with the Democratic Alliance. We were sort of parachuted in, as it were. I know I was parachuted in by Helen. I'm not sure who enticed Glynis to do the same, but she'll tell a bit about that as well. But in the book, and I was rereading bits and pieces of it, I just want to quote a few things to you, so you'll give you a taste of who we're dealing with. And I quote from the book, "I was forever in trouble. I spent practically my entire high school career in detention, either for not doing my homework or for being cheeky. I was defiant. I didn't like it when teachers bullied other kids, when they humiliated them. I've always hated bullies." That's probably why I got a few smacks from her when we first met. But I want to take you on a little bit where she then says, and I miss a few pages, "I was probably a particularly rude and obnoxious child, a little like I am as an adult, I suppose. I thought everyone else was odd, and that was fine. It never occurred to me that the fault might lie with me. I think my grandmother Olga got me, though. We communicated very easily. She was interesting and told wonderful stories. But she never spoke much about her family. Her mother died when she was very young." Which then I want to take on a little bit further. 3 days before my grandmother died, she told me she was Jewish. This is your maternal grandmother. "It's not safe to be a Jew," she said. And that was all the explanation I ever got from her. None of her children knew. Her Jewish heritage was not a subject that was ever discussed. My mother had always told me that I was allergic to pork. I love that. After my grandmother died, my mother and her sisters were not remotely interested in researching the subject or discussing it. Even today, her two surviving sisters had no real information in this regard. I'm not sure if the sisters are still surviving. I wasn't astonished at my grandmother's revelations for the simple reason that my grandmother had pretty much told me the same thing a short while before when my grandmother became ill. Your godmother had said. My grandmother had been ill for a long time, but she was compos mentis when she told me she was Jewish. She was in no condition to discuss it, but only confirmed what I already knew. I won't go on, but it's a fascinating book to read, absolutely fascinating and really worthwhile. And I can recommend it. It's still on the shelves at most of the bookshops. I did go to a bookshop recently and there it was. So there are still copies. But if you can't get copy, I'm sure you can get hold of Nechama, who probably has kept a few of her own as keepsakes, but you can wheedle it out of her, I'm sure. But Glynis, I just want to lead into you now and to tell me a little bit about that revelation when you found out you were Jewish.
Yeah, Bagsy, it was so it was certainly a revelation in that, it had never been an issue that was ever remotely discussed in my family. I was brought up as a Methodist. But I was brought up in Kimberley, and Kimberley had a very large and very vibrant Jewish community. And most of my friends at school were Jewish. So I spent a lot of my time in Jewish households, going to shul with my Jewish friends. Doing Friday night suppers with the Cohens every Friday night. So it was not a culture that I was unfamiliar with. And it was certainly a culture that I resonated with and enjoyed. But I had
Just
no
to
clue.
interrupt you, just to interrupt you about the Jewish background. I have, in fact, over the past few years, also met a lot of your friends from Kimberley, your Jewish friends,
Really?
who have told me, yeah, sorry about that, but
Yeah.
they've told me some of the most intimate details of your early days of roughing it and playing sport and horse riding and your love for animals and all that.
I love
They've
you so
fit
much,
me.
Bexy.
Well, a true animal I am. But sorry, I interrupted you.
Oh, no, that's fine. Yeah, so Kimberley was a great place to grow up in. I mean, it was a city. But not a big one. It was very, very safe. It was a beautiful city, and it was really a wonderful privilege to grow up there. It's no longer quite so beautiful. But Kimberley was a great place to grow up in. Sadly, and Kimberley has, in my view, the most beautiful shul in South Africa.
Yeah, I love that shul.
Yes,
Whenever
I
I'm
mean
there, I do visit.
the Gardner shul is very lovely, but the Kimberley shul is, in my view, even better. Sadly, today they're unable to even form a minyan, and Barney Horwitz looks after the place, and the Jewish community is very, very small. Only 2 to 3 families are left. So it
Yeah.
used to be a big, thriving, vibrant Jewish community. It was wonderful,
I
but
know
no.
Barry Katz goes back from time to time and he tells me they can't get a minion together.
Yeah, no, Barry.
But he loves it there.
Yeah, so Barry's just been there. He's just come back from Kimberley now, and I'm going there on Thursday to fetch my puppy.
Wow, a
Yeah,
brand
so
new puppy.
my dear friend Trevor Datno passed away in March. His dog has had puppies, and I'm getting one of them for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Barry does go back often, and Barry's sister Muxi still lives there. The Datnos are still there, the Hurwitzes are still there. Very, very, very small Jewish communities left. Very small.
Well,
Sadly.
it gave a beautiful sort of upbringing for you. It gave it probably was a great influence on your personality today and made you a personable person, if I may say. I know you're going to hit me for that, but a lovable person, if you don't mind. Glynis, it was your maternal forebears that were Jewish, and therefore, in Jewish law, and you explain that in your book as well, you are in fact Jewish, and your growth into Judaism has been quite something. I know you're not a religious person by any sense of the imagination, but what I do know is that you are a person that is probably defined as a Zionist. And I'm going to break there and just have a quick ad break because we need to pay the bills.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Hi, you're back with Michael Bagram on Chai FM, and thank you. It's every Tuesday morning between 9 and 10. Please tune in. We have exciting talks, and I have the most brilliant guests, and I've got Advocate Glynis Breytenbach, MP, with me today. And we were just coming into, both of us have an enormous love of Israel. We've been there many times together, and I just want to quickly look at one other thing in the book, Glynis, before you carry on. And you say, I'm not a religious person, but the way of life appeals to me. I like that there's some structure to it. The traditions and customs are fun, and there's a strong sense of community. I like the loyalty the Jewish community exhibits. The Jewish community makes a serious effort to look after its own, but also to look after everyone else. Charity is a big thing for Jewish people, which is something that I admire. And I love Israel. It was carved out of nothing and it works. It's magnificent, which then leads me on to a comment that you're about to make about Israel. Glynis, over to you.
I do love Israel. My first visit to Israel was with you and Darren Bergman, and it was fantastic. I loved it. And it was a bucket list item for me to go to Israel. So I'm extremely fortunate to have been many times with you and with Daisy and other times. And I really do. I love Israel. I admire everything that they've achieved and continue to achieve. And yes, I'm certainly identify as a Zionist. No question about it.
Just to take you on from there, I mean, we have in Parliament, in 2014, in fact, I got a call from a Canadian MP at the time. I don't know if you remember the discussion because we were sitting next to each other. I was also a bit peed off with you because you, when I went outside, you were looking at my, not my laptop, what's called my computer that I had in front of me. And you'd said, what's this issue about the Jewish Parliamentarians Association? That's all Jewish parliamentarians outside Israel, which was formed then. It's been dysfunctional. But at the time, we started talking about getting together a little Jewish caucus in Parliament. We had an enormous caucus, all three of us. We called ourselves the Three Musketeers. And it was a bit difficult to choose who was going to be chair, vice chair, and treasurer, but there you have it. We now have Jack, who has joined us, so we're now the Four Musketeers.
Yes.
Just before that, can you comment on some of the ideas that we were putting together? And in fact, you were the chief thinker of this, of trying to get us to go to Israel and to take other MPs.
Yeah, well, you know, we wanted to expose South Africans and other people to the wonderful achievements that Israel is. There's a lot of misunderstandings. Israel is good at everything except its own public relations, in my view.
Yeah.
It struggles with its own public relations. And so people have a skewed view of what Israel is all about. And about their achievements. And people seem to think that Israel is made up of only Jewish Israelis. And we both know that this is not correct. And so we discussed how we could expose other people to the wonderful achievements of Israel. And we set up this thing where we found a very generous donor who funded trips of MPs for a number of years, seven trips, of the most anti-Israeli, anti-Semitic MPs that would agree to go to Israel. That was the initial idea, and expose them to Israel, to a real honest warts and all trip of Israel, not a sell the pretty bits of Israel, a warts and all trip to Israel, which was then, you know, we put together at the end of each year with, and was fully funded by the donor, and we took, you know, 7 trips of 12 MPs each, and exposed them to the very best, and the very most difficult of Israel, and I think they were very successful trips. And you know, neither of us, and Dazzy was also involved. We didn't expect to, you know, bring people back converted to Zionism. We asked that we made it clear there would be no quid pro quo. Nothing would ever be asked of them, and that you know, as long as they went with an open mind, that was it. And I think largely we had a success rate in that people came back with a much better understanding of how Israel is composed and what Israel in fact is and does.
Well, in fact, I was going to make the comment that majority, over 90% of the people who did come back, who we thought were not great fans of Israel, at least came back and said the situation is complicated, and they weren't great fans of Israel at that, even coming back, but they're saying it's complicated. They were saying that it needs a lot more understanding, and therefore they'd rather not comment in the future, because they feel that you know, what we expose them to were things that most tourists don't see. For instance, we went to see the PLO. We went to see the representatives of the Arab community. We did amazing things. I mean, I've been to Israel, call it 40 times now in my lifetime, but at no stage during those all those trips was I ever exposed to what we put together as an interesting trip. We had a wonderful guide. I can't remember her name. What was her name again?
Emily Nielsen.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Emily Nielsen, who in fact was initially a very committed Christian and has converted to Judaism, but has, let's call it, tentacles in each community, Muslim, Jewish, and Christian, and has taken us to see the best and the worst of those times. We've had a few failures.
Yes,
I won't name them. I won't name them, but there were two rather nasty failures.
Yeah.
But you know, one or two are still involved with us, so let's not say that.
Each to his own. But I think we had a good success rate. And certainly it was an eye-opener for a lot of people, and I think for us as well. So, you know, I recall when we went to the one purely fortuitously, the interaction was fortuitous. We went to Ramallah, and they'd asked to see a refugee camp, which we took them to. And the MPs were expecting to find sort of a tented camp like you see in South Africa.
Yeah.
What they found are apartment blocks, proper apartment blocks. In which people
and five-star accommodation.
Yeah, and they've been living there for 70 years. Never moved out. So never gotten a job, never bought a house, never moved out. Just lived there as refugees for 70 years. And the one very skeptical MP asked, you know, why are you still here after 70 years? And the answer was, because the eyes of the world are upon us.
Yeah. What amazed me was going into the Mercedes-Benz dealership to see the brand new million-dollar Mercedes-Benz for sale, and asking the salesman how many sales does he have a week, and he says he had 2 or 3 very good sales a week.
Yeah, no problem. There've been a couple of eye-opening moments in Israel, and then of course the Israeli technology and the startup abilities in Israel blew people away. What they achieve, how they continue to thrive, and the agriculture. You know, so, Israel is the greatest country, and yet they have no shortage of water. They could feed. If we could adopt Israeli agricultural technology in South Africa, we could feed our entire population with very little difficulty.
And have no starvation at schools,
But nobody, but of course that's, you know, not something that is going to be happening anytime soon. But people have been blown away by the possibilities,
Okay, to go back to you, which is a much more interesting subject right
oh,
now.
Hell no.
Your love of animals. I know that whenever you come around to our house, although our dog unfortunately has passed on, Avasholem, you were always the first person you greeted when, and I say the first person in proverbial terms you greeted was my dog. I had wonderful boxes, and we haven't replaced the last box, unfortunately. It was it was a bit traumatic for us, so we're getting over that, but we will. Patsy has said we will do it eventually. We just couldn't face it afterwards. It is traumatic. I mean, you've also had to say goodbye
traumatic.
To dogs.
And but you must give another dog an opportunity.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, and we will do so. But that's been your love as animals. Yes. I know, and I mentioned early on your love of horses, and you actually did horse riding competitively, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Tell us a bit about that.
Well, I did show jumping competitively until I went to university, but it's a very expensive sport. And then, you know, it was impossible to make any money as a show jumper. It just cost money. Even now, it's very difficult to make any significant kind of money as a show jumper in South Africa. It costs a hell of a lot. Horses are very expensive. And so when I went to university, it was no longer possible. And I stopped riding competitively, although I kept horses until just before I came to Parliament. I kept my own horses, which I rode on my own property. Yeah.
And that was up in Pretoria, am I correct?
Yes, I lived on a small holding in Pretoria, particularly so that I could keep my own horses. But when the last horse died of very old age, I didn't replace him. Because A, it's very expensive, and B, I knew I was coming to Parliament, and you need a lot of time to spend on horses. They don't only need to be fed; they need a lot of quality time and a lot of exercise, which I certainly now don't have the time to supply them with.
Yeah, in fact, you started one of the chapters in your book, and the heading is "Animals Are Nicer Than People."
Well,
I took umbrage to that, so we'll have that out later.
Oh, well, just but, suck it up.
But then you, underneath, there was a quote from you that obviously Nechama pulled out and put in there and said, "You must never make the mistake of believing you are the person your dog thinks you are."
Yes,
I love that. Because your dog always thinks you're absolutely great and fantastic.
Yes, I think for politicians it's excellent advice.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm thinking.
Politicians seem to think that they're, you know, sometimes seem to, you know, view life, their own lives through rose-tinted spectacles. We aren't the people our dogs think we are. We should be cognizant of that every single day.
Well, just to tell everyone that, in fact, you got your provincial show jumping colors on, I think it was your last horse that you had. I'm not sure if that's correct, but I know you got your provincial show jumping colors. So mazel tov on that. I know it was a few years back.
Very long time ago.
Okay, so you went off to university. Tell us a little bit about university and what you qualified as, and take us into that.
Well, I went off to Wits after I finished school, did a BA. Then I decided I wanted to do law. And so my father said, well, it's fine, you can study law, but then you must do it at the Free State University, because he and my mother had then moved to Bloemfontein. And so I said, no, I'm not studying at an Afrikaans university, so no. So he said, well, that's absolutely fine, then just get a job.
that doesn't leave you any choice whatsoever.
Yeah, so I worked for a year at Wits. Really didn't enjoy working at all. And the next year I went to Free State to do law, which I loved. I loved both doing the law, and I loved being at Free State University, which was wonderful. I made wonderful friends there that are still my friends, because there was a very small group of English-speaking students in my class. So there were maybe five of us. Not that there was anything wrong with the Afrikaans-speaking students, and many of them are also still my friends today. But the English little group was small and very close-knit. So I had a great time doing a B. Juris and an LLB at the Free State University. Loved it.
Oh, well, that's good. I was at the English equivalent called Rhodes University. Far better than Free State. Far better than Free State, but there we have it.
Dream on.
You then, after university, then went on to the prosecution services. Tell us a bit about that journey.
Well, I did. It was actually sort of by default. You know, in Bloemfontein, the LLB degree was only offered part-time, so at night. And so all of us, you know, we do our articles during the daytime because what else do you do? And having done them, I was thoroughly convinced that I didn't want to be an attorney. No offense.
And, no, I don't mind. Nor did I want to be. I just unfortunately got caught up.
And so when I finished my LLB, then those were the choices. You know, you either became an attorney, finished your articles, became an attorney, or you prosecuted. There weren't really many other avenues. I didn't certainly think of becoming a legal advisor or anything like that. I had no experience. There was a great shortage of prosecutors at that time in Gauteng. And so I got a job at the Johannesburg Magistrates Court as a prosecutor. And from about day three, I absolutely knew this was what I was born to do. I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
Nice and litigious.
Litigious, aggressive. You know, but prosecuting, if you do it properly, if you can do prosecuting honestly and with integrity, you can make a difference in people's lives every single day. A significant difference. And I absolutely loved it. I loved it. I loved being a prosecutor.
But as you moved on, you went through different stages. You went to different places and did different types of prosecution.
Run of the mill, everything you learn. It's a huge learning curve, a very, very steep learning curve. Because, of course, you know, when you leave university, you don't really know anything about law. You just know where to find it.
I didn't know what a summons looked like.
Yeah, well, I couldn't fill in the summons when I arrived with all my degrees. I couldn't fill in the summons. It was just, and my interpreter, in fact, taught me how to prosecute. Mrs. Macabella taught me how to, when to stand up, when to sit down, when to call witnesses, when to address the court, and even wrote down questions for me to cross-examine. She taught me how to prosecute, and I acknowledged her in my book. And when she turned 70 a few years ago, Nahama and I went to her birthday party in Soweto.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely wonderful woman. So, you know, I learned a lot. General run-of-the-mill prosecutions, that was great. I loved it. But I always wanted to specialize in commercial law. So, you know, fraud, corruption, money laundering, that kind of thing. The person who was in charge of it in Johannesburg said to me that over his dead body, would a woman ever enter that unit? And
well, hopefully he died.
He's still alive, but I did it.
Okay. Sorry I said that.
No. It's fine. So when do you, so eventually he moved to a different unit, and then my boss took over that unit and took me with him. And I eventually became the head of that unit. And then in 1992, I went to the Attorney General's office in Pretoria, as it was then still known. Later became the Director of Public Prosecutions. And from there, we started the Specialized Commercial Crime Unit in Pretoria as a project, which was unbelievably successful. Yeah.
We're going to, just before you carry on, we're going to pay the bills again.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Hi, thank you. You're back with Michael Bagram every Tuesday morning between 9 and 10, and I appreciate you tuning in. I'm here with a wonderful guest, Advocate Glynis Breitenbach, MP. Glynis has been telling us a bit about her background and her life, and I just want to take you through just another sentence from the book, The Accidental Law Student, and it's that chapter, The Rule of Law by Glynis Breitenbach and help by Nahama Brody. Glynis, you said as follows, and I read it, but otherwise I was usually bone idle. I'm naturally very lazy. Now, Glynis, I beg to differ. You've, in Parliament since 2014, is the only time I can actually comment with some knowledge, You've been incredibly busy. You've moved from pillar to post, but in particular, you started, well, not started, but you put together the first time a professional unit within the Democratic Alliance, and it's the Federal Legal Commission, an unbelievable unit. It is extremely busy. I know you're not the director of it, but you basically have your hand on every single movement in this Federal Legal Unit. Tell us a bit about it, and why is it so successful, and why is it so necessary?
Well, Bagsy, you know, the FLC existed before I came to Parliament.
Certainly. Correct.
And it was chaired by Hendrik Schmidt, who was also an ex-prosecutor. And then Hendrik didn't want to continue with that job anymore. And so, you know, I suppose for the lack of any other willing candidate, I was nominated to chair it. And the Federal Legal Commission is an independent body within the Democratic Alliance, which is really very laudable, you know, that a political party has such an independent disciplinary arm. That being said, of course, it remains inside a political party and therefore is not, you know, strictly operated strictly according to the rules of evidence and, you know, that kind of thing. Although we do have rules and they are very close to the rules of evidence. We follow good administrative law practice and we certainly implement the rule of law and, you know, the principles of fairness and legality. So for that reason, the FLC is successful. It is independent. It is not beholden to anybody. The decisions made by panels of the Federal Legal Commission are presented to the Federal Executive and the Federal Council, where they can accept them. They have the right to interfere or change the sanction of such decisions, but only on good reason, and good reason has a very specific legal meaning. And so it is independent. It operates, I think successfully in that I think people accept generally that they will get a fair deal at the FLC. That is largely due to the great work done by Danielle Crowe and Marius Victor, who are the administrative staff members of the FLC. And of course, I have enormous help from the deputy chairperson, who is Werner Horn. And then we have 60 members of the FLC, 60 members of the Democratic Alliance, 30 of whom have a legal qualification and 30 of whom do not. And they form the panels that adjudicate all the matters that come before the FLC. And you're on that panel, as you are well aware. And all of those members give up their time for no recompense at all, except you know, making a huge contribution to the party, and often have to deal with complex legal matters, and they do it so very well. It takes up quite a lot of time. It's completely voluntary, and I'm very grateful to that panel of people who constantly assist us, sometimes under very difficult circumstances.
Yeah, I am a member. I haven't been that active, and I apologize to you for that, but I do know that the panels are absolutely fantastic. I mean, I've also been defending people within the FLC. I've also helped prosecute on one occasion. And the panels are unbelievable. I mean, they do a lot of work. They do a lot of research. And they're not beholden to politicians.
No.
And I want to thank you for that, because you've kept that very carefully away from politics. In other words, because so-and-so is my friend, we're gonna let him off. Now, I've been very involved recently, with your permission, thank you, in another political party's legal commission. You know, I don't know what the hell they call it, but it's more like a jumped up. I don't know what it is. It's most unbelievable. There's no justice. There's no procedure. It's decided on whether I like this person or not, and whether I'm going to find them guilty or not. And it's not a small political party, I can tell you that much. And in fact, my experience now, and you've probably had that experience for other political parties, seeing how they run, my experience has been with four other political parties, and they have no semblance of justice at all. There's no administrative justice at all. So the DA stands much different to all the other political parties. I haven't experienced all of them, but at least four other political parties where I've tried to defend people. And you're defending people on the basis of who likes you, who can we approach, how can we do that, sure, as opposed to law. So well done to you and the panelists and to all the other representatives that you have. I've had one or two extremely interesting cases. You might recall I once went up to Durban to do the most weird case I've ever been involved in my life. And I've done some really weird things because I acted as a prosecutor in the army.
Yeah.
But the case that I was sent up there to Durban, the start of that case, and you might call, I'll mention the phrase that led that case into a case was, it was a WhatsApp sent to Helen Ziller at 2 a.m. saying, call off your bitches. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes, I remember, yeah.
Call off your bitches. And of course, Helen was up and working at 2 a.m.
Of course she was, yes.
And immediately contacted...
down a building somewhere.
Yeah, and immediately contacted the FLC, who then answered at 6 a.m, and then I was now engaged in this. So it was the weirdest experience I've ever had. So
just have a propensity to misbehave, yes.
Yeah, they were quite naughty in Durban. And it did lead, unfortunately, to, sadly, one of the city councils leaving. Just to move on a little bit, because our time's moving on, unfortunately, you've been appointed as a chairperson of a portfolio. Tell us a bit about that.
I'm the co-chairperson of the Constitutional Review Committee of Parliament.
A hell of a duty that is. Tell us a bit about it.
It's a very interesting committee. I've served on it since 2014. So what happens is that at the outset of the committee, when it's constituted, we call for recommendations, requests, motivations for constitutional amendments for the South African Constitution, just generally. And we get many. We get this time around, we got, you know, well in excess of 1,000.
Oh.
And then, you know, we work through each one of them, see which ones are viable, which ones are not. Some of them are not viable. For instance, you know, cessation of the Western Cape from the rest of South Africa, that kind of thing. Of course, you know, you cannot pay much attention to those. But there are some really important ones that are then sent for a proper legal evaluation by the parliamentary legal advisors. Presentations are made to the committee by the proponents thereof, and in some instances they result in legislation. For instance, in the last parliament, South African Sign Language became the 12th official language of South Africa, and that's had its inception as a suggestion at the Constitutional Review Committee.
I didn't know that.
That and others have. So, you know, people think the Constitution is cast in stone. It's not. It's been amended 21 times.
Can I hold you there? Hold that thought. We're going to pay the bills again.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Well, welcome back. You're with Michael Bagram and Glynis Breitenbach. We're having a wonderful conversation. I'm enjoying it thoroughly, and I'm hoping that everyone else is. Thank you for tuning in every Tuesday between 9 and 10. Now Glynis, I'll cut in there about your work on the Constitution. Now, just my comment is, I'm not an expert in constitutional law, but I know our Constitution reasonably well. I read it from time to time. I have to keep going back to it in certain cases that I'm involved in. It is a wonderful Constitution. I quite frankly, I'm very proud of the South African Constitution, and I think it's working. Yes, we've had our hitches. We've had our ups and downs with some very naughty people in this country. But if we properly implemented our Constitution and our justice system, I fail to see why it is necessary for amendments. But yes, I understand that You like, for instance, introducing sign language is a good amendment. Do you feel you're doing good work there and you're enjoying it?
Yes, I think we do very good work. It's a joint committee, so between the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces, it's a big committee. But I think we do good work. I think it's very necessary work, and I agree with you. We've got a wonderful constitution. It's a world-class constitution, very thoughtfully and diligently put together. But of course, it was done in 1994, and the current constitution is from 1996. And things change over a period of 30 years. Circumstances change, and issues evolve, and so it's necessary for the constitution to be available for amendment to deal with issues that arise. For instance, we're busy now, the DA drafting a constitutional amendment to prevent to bring a requirement of a fit and proper. For members of committees and really for members of parliament, because I don't think that the drafters of the constitution ever foresaw that there may be people entering parliament who in fact didn't meet the requirement of fit and proper.
Yeah,
And
I can mention a couple, but yeah.
yes, so can I. And so they have, so that is an amendment that we believe is necessary, and we're working on that. That's the DA now, not the committee.
Yeah.
So the committee will hear those kinds of requests and decide upon them, rank them according to their priority list, and then try and in a 5-year term try and deal with as many as possible.
Now, you've also put in a private member's bill.
Several.
Well, there's one that really strikes me as being absolutely necessary, and that is to get an independent policing body in South Africa after what we've been hearing in the Madlanga Commission. And I recently interviewed Advocate Paul Hoffman, who's been
Yeah.
singing praises about your suggestions to have some sort of independent body, almost like bringing the scorpions back, but with more power. Can you comment on
Yes.
that?
So, the Scorpions were very successful, and the reason for their demise was the fact that they were housed within the National Prosecuting Authority, and so
Yeah.
it could be disbanded with a simple majority in Parliament, so 50% plus one, which is why they were disbanded, because they went after politicians, amongst others, and they're well connected, and people didn't like that. Having, I was in the National Prosecuting Authority at that time, and the muscle memory remains. So now they've, the ANC have set up in the Department of Justice and housed it within the National Prosecuting Authority, this independent Directorate of Investigation, Anti-Corruption, IDAC. Which is again housed within the National Prosecuting Authority. It
They're
has no
answerable now
independence.
that.
No. It's vulnerable to being closed down. Their budget is dependent solely upon the largesse of justice and the NPA. And if we want to have a truly independent anti-corruption body in South Africa, which we desperately need, then we need to form an independent body. We've called it the Anti-Corruption Commission, but it can be called anything you like. That is separate from the National Prosecuting Authority, that require a heightened majority in Parliament to disband. So no party would ever have that kind of majority again. That will give it the kind of independence that it needs in order to give people security of tenure.
It's absolutely necessary after what we're reading about right now. And in fact, you're involved in some of the shenanigans, if I can call it that, at the upper echelons of our police force. They don't deserve to be called policemen.
We're in serious trouble, and we need this body to fix it. There's no other way.
Okay, and as we're in the dying moments of our discussion, you've been appointed as the chief whip. Now, I don't think you ever imagined that that would ever happen, but it's happened, and you're working like a dog there. And if you can, a few seconds, we get to wrap up. But let us know what you feel about the chief whip position, and I wish you mazel tov officially on that.
Thank you. So it's not a position that I ever thought I would occupy, and it's certainly not a position that I sought to occupy. But here we are. It's a huge amount of work. I'm still learning. We'll see how it goes. I hope to make a success of it, and I hope to be a good chief whip to all the members of the caucus.
And I am one of your whips, so I'm enjoying it thoroughly. So thank you. And Glynis, I want to now thank you publicly also for being on the show with us, spending of your time.
Thank you.
And despite all your wants and necessities, you are a lovable person. So thank you very much. And we look forward to having you on air again on High FM. So thank you.
Thank you, Bagsy. It was nice to talk to you. Take care.
All right.
Ciao, ciao.